So, and I want to thank Paul for pointing out that I'm not just resources for the future, also a professor at the University of Maryland, and the university likes me to say that. You can probably tell that I'm an academic because I'm massively underdressed compared to most of the people in the room. So that's the academic side of things. And I'm going to take a slightly academic approach here. So sort of try and back up a little bit. So I'm going to start by talking about trying to address directly the question that sort of frames this panel. Is it as simple as a price on carbon? And then at the end, I'm going to respond quickly to a few of the things Dallas said, although I think he had told me beforehand that I'd want to sort of spend a lot of time responding, and I think I agree with him more than he was expecting me to. But not on everything, so I'll get to that toward the end. So let me start by just saying I think a price on carbon would be the single biggest thing that could be done to promote adoption of clean energy technologies, development of clean energy technologies, any of that. But that's not really what this panel's asking. This panel right here, for the next hour or until Representative Barton shows up, we're talking about whether a price on carbon is enough, whether it's that simple. And in order to answer that question, we have to back up a couple steps and ask, first, why we want to promote adoption of clean technologies. Because you can always say, you can always do more. We can always push adoption harder. But the question is not sort of how can we get the most adoption possible. It's how can we get the right amount of adoption? Because there are always trade-offs. There's always going to be something we're giving up. And there's going to be some cost. And so we need to figure out sort of how do we get the right amount of adoption. And to do that, we need to know why it is we want to promote that adoption. Or another way of putting it, which I think may be the better way to think about it, is why is the market on its own doing too little? So I'll start by giving an answer that says a carbon tax is enough, or a price on carbon more generally, and then talk about a bunch of reasons why that initial simple answer is not quite right. If the reason that we care about clean tech adoption is because of CO2 emissions being too high, so if we're worried about climate change, CO2 is driving climate change, the people who are burning fossil fuels aren't paying the price that they're imposing, and that's the market failure underlying everything, that externality. If that's the case, then just putting in a price on carbon is going to take care of that. That once that's priced correctly, then everyone has the right incentive. They're paying the full cost of that fuel that's being burned. Once you're paying the full cost, you have the right incentives to adopt a cleaner technology. So you can save money by doing that, and that gets the incentives right. And in particular, if you've set the price correctly, not only does it get the incentives right, but it's going to do better, it's going to be more cost effective than any other policy that you could be pursuing. Because it's going to be giving incentives on all the different ways you could reduce emissions. So it's not just sort of pushing clean energy. It's also encouraging energy efficiency. It's encouraging novel production methods. It's sort of all the different ways you could get at this. From a technology standpoint, the big advantage there is you don't have to predict where the technology is going to go. You've created the incentive, and you can let the innovative people out there who understand the technologies better than anybody in this room or anybody in Washington, let them figure out where the technology should go. And I think the SO2 cap and trade program is a fantastic example of this, that if you look at what was predicted for how electric generators would respond to this, everyone expected they'd install scrubbers. And what happened instead, you didn't get a breakthrough technology, but you got a whole bunch of little improvements, the ones that Dallas was talking about. So you figure out how to blend coal a little bit differently. You make other sort of small changes in the plant. And the result of that is the costs were several times lower, depending on who you listen to. Sort of the estimates are, a third, a half, a sixth, something like that. But the costs were much lower than anyone was forecasting because we couldn't predict exactly what technology was going to come in. So you gave the incentive. The technologies developed, it wasn't a big breakthrough, but you add up all those little innovations, they added up to enough to cut the cost by roughly a third, or cut it to a third of what it was, cut it by two-thirds. That's a big difference. And all of that comes about through sort of the flexibility, not just pushing scrubbers, but sort of providing the incentive and letting the plant managers and engineers and people like that figure it out. The other thing is that you'd get a lot of other benefits. So if we have a carbon tax, you get revenue from that. You can use that to cut other taxes. You can use it to pay down the deficit. There are a lot of good things that you can do with that. We've done a lot of modeling of that at RFF. I'd be happy to talk about that if people are interested, but not going to focus on it in these initial remarks. Let me just say, while I'm in that section, that if we are going to price carbon, both from other perspectives, but particularly from a technology perspective, a carbon tax is probably the best way to do that. A couple reasons for that. The biggest one is that it gives you a stable price signal. And you don't necessarily get that with permits. As we've seen with the SO2 permit market, as we've seen with the European Union's ETS system, prices can be highly volatile under a cap and trade type of system. And if there's one thing that investors like, or people who are installing some new technology, it's a predictable return. And if you've got a predictable price on carbon and you've got a carbon-saving technology, that gives you a predictable return. And that's a pretty important piece of what's going on. So you don't get that with cap and trade. So that's a substantial advantage there. Once we've done that, you've priced it correctly, everybody's got the right incentive to reduce emissions through technology or to reduce emissions some other way. So if that's the only reason that we want to be promoting clean technology, or it's the only problem, the only sort of market failure going on, then a carbon price is enough. It is that simple. And I think that's a good place to start the discussion, but you can't stop there. So let me run through a few reasons why we might want to do more than just the price on carbon. The first would be that you might worry that a price on carbon might persist until we, suppose we put in a price on carbon, then we get some breakthrough technology that makes it really cheap to do away with fossil fuels. And then Congress says, well, you know what? We're crushing the fossil fuel industry. Let's get rid of this price on carbon. If the people developing the technology or implementing the technology are sort of thinking forward and realize Congress might do that, they don't necessarily have the right incentives. So this political uncertainty is, or suppose it's not even a breakthrough, suppose it's just we get a different administration, a different Congress, and that price comes back out, then it goes back in, then it comes back out. I'm not sure we're going to see this. Doesn't seem likely we'll see a price on carbon at all anytime soon. But certainly if you look at things like the incentive for wind, that's been a very erratic price signal. And not erratic because there's anything in the market that's doing it. It's erratic because Congress is doing it. And that kind of thing is a worry about any kind of policy like that. Another issue you might have is it's very hard for innovators or adopters of clean technology to capture all the benefit of that. There are a lot of spillovers in technology, both in the development and in the adoption. And in that case, you want to be doing more than just pricing the carbon. You want to be giving some additional push to sort of compensate for that, the fact that the people innovating and adopting don't get all the benefits. That, you know, if one firm puts something in, other firms can see what they do, can copy it, and it's cheaper for them. And those kinds of gains, that first adopter doesn't get the benefit of that. A closely related issue is the infrastructure issue. There's with a lot of these technologies, there's a real chicken and egg problem that you don't want to adopt unless a whole lot of other people adopt. So think about some new car technology that requires retrofitting all the gas stations. So we're not going to burn gasoline, we're going to burn some other fuel. Nobody's going to want to buy the car until somebody builds the gas stations. Nobody's going to want to build the gas stations or hydrogen stations or whatever they are until people have the cars. That's something where just a price on carbon isn't going to overcome that problem by itself. So in those cases, there's a reason for a technology-specific push. For the spillovers, it may just be a matter of having subsidies for adoption or tax credits or something like that. The chicken and egg issue is a little tougher. You actually need some push that's going to, and you may actually have to have sort of picking winners there in order to figure out which direction to push. So that's one case where a price on carbon might not be enough. If we really have these, what economists would call network externalities. So you sort of need the network of hydrogen stations before anyone will buy a hydrogen car or whatever the analogous thing is for some other technology. That's one where, the market by itself is not necessarily going to push us down the right path. And so it may take some nudge, but that's hard to do. So the caution on this, for the spillovers, It's not clear why spillovers in green technology are any bigger than spillovers in any other technology. So it may argue for a broad-based research, development, deployment type of credit, but not something that is specific to green technology. For the sort of chicken and egg issue, the network externalities issue, you know, if we can identify the right technology and give it a good shove down the right path, you can do a lot of good with that. But that depends on government being able to identify in advance which is the right technology, and that's a very difficult problem. So these are sort of reasons to do more, but there are also reasons for caution there. A final reason that I think is potentially fairly important is there are places in the world that are unlikely to have a price on carbon anytime soon. So China is experimenting with this, but we haven't seen anything in India, and I think it's going to be quite a while before China, you know, they've got a pilot carbon tax, they've got pilot carbon trading programs, but they're unlikely to do very much for a fairly lengthy period of time. One thing that the rest of the world can do to promote cuts in carbon emissions in developing countries is to innovate in low-carbon technologies. That if we can make it cheaper to do something non-carbon intensive than to burn fossil fuels, we don't have to twist China's arm or twist India's arm or whatever developing country you're interested in. We just have to give them access to the technology. And that's one thing technology can do that a price can't do. You know, we can't put a price in everywhere in the world. So that's sort of one more reason why we might want to do something on technology other than just a price on carbon. Okay. So that's, I think, covers everything that I came in with prepared remarks. Let me quickly turn to a couple of things Dallas said. I sort of feel a little bit like I'm nitpicking on some of these, but I think they're fairly important points. So just early on, Dallas was arguing that a carbon price wouldn't necessarily do very much because of state RPS rules that are in place, that what's driving the renewables is going to be the RPS, and unless the carbon price is really high, it's not going to make any difference, that what's really going to make the difference is what those RPS limits are. That's true if the states keep their RPSs the same, whether or not we have a carbon tax, or whether or not we have a cap and trade system, or whatever your carbon pricing is. But some research I've done shows that the incentives for the states change a lot. That if there's a price on carbon, that's a national level price on carbon, it becomes a whole lot cheaper for a state to have an RPS. That, you know, sort of doing exactly what it was doing before, but in addition to the other benefits the state's getting, it's also saving carbon taxes or saving carbon permit, you know, payments or whatever it is, being paid by companies in that state. So it gives sort of an extra reason for those states to tighten their RPSs. So even if you believe that the RPS is going to move what's driving it, it's reasonable to believe that states will see the national carbon price and respond to it by implementing tighter RPSs. So it may take a while, but seems like something that reasonably could happen. On the carbon tax versus cap and trade, there's a recent study out of RFF pointing out the difference in price paths that you get. That the price under cap and trade is rising at the rate of interest, price under carbon tax would be rising more slowly. 2 points on that. The first is that a lot of the research suggests that the correct price path, that, you know, from an economic standpoint, what you want to do is have the price on carbon match up with the damage that carbon is doing. That damage that carbon is doing, all the estimates have it rising less quickly than the rate of interest. So what that suggests is, from an economic standpoint, cap and trade would have the price rising too fast. So it's actually sort of better, at least if you start in the right place, which is a giant if, but that to have a slower rising price than a cap and trade would have. Second point is, if you want a fast rising price, you can do that with a carbon tax. If you want a slow rising price, you can do that with a carbon tax. If you want a flat price, you can do that. You have a lot more flexibility about the price path with a carbon tax than you have with a cap and trade system. Cap and trade locks in, at least if you allow banking, locks in a rise at the rate of interest. You don't necessarily get that with a carbon tax. And if you don't necessarily want that, that extra flexibility could be a good thing. Finally, on Dallas's point about institutions and the idea that regulation may be able to adapt more quickly than something like a carbon tax or a cap and trade program that's enacted through legislation. Again, 2 points there. First, I think it's, you know, this is getting outside my area of specialty, I'm an economist, not a political scientist, relatively recently coming to Washington. I was at the University of Texas before that, which is about as far from Washington as you can get, I think, not literally, but figuratively. And nobody laughed at that. I think it's a little dangerous to extrapolate from recent history that we know for the set of Congresses we've had, for the set of EPA administrations we've had, we get a particular sort of set of results. And you can argue that regulation has been more effective because of the way it's changed over time, and cap and trade has been stuck. It's not clear to me that under a different set of circumstances with a different set of Congresses and a different set of regulatory administrators that you would necessarily get that result. So I think it's a little dangerous to extrapolate. The other point is, even if we do accept that it's more flexible, flexibility is in some ways a good thing, in some ways a bad thing. That the ability to react to new information is a very good thing. On the other hand, the ability to change may be a bad thing. You know, if we're trying to get people to implement a new technology, you're trying to get them to do something now that's going to have a payoff over a long span of time in the future. If you can promise them there will be this carbon price, it will be in place, it will follow this path, and it's going to be very hard to change, then you have a very different situation for those investors or those innovators than you would have if it's something that, you know, the next EPA administrator could come in and could tweak that rule. And that kind of predictability is pretty important. So that's a sense in which flexibility, particularly from a technology standpoint, may be a bad thing. So this is sort of a double-edged sword. Reacting to new information is a good thing, but you know, the people with investing in the technology, developing the technology, predictability is good for them. Okay, I think that's what I want to say, and I look forward to everybody's questions.
Thank you very much, both Dallas and Rob. While we're waiting for Congressman Barton, and before we open it up for questions from the other members of the panel, I would like to make 2 points, and if I could get the presentation put up here, we can skip to it quickly, which is one of the themes that I think is consistent, certainly if you take the long-run view between the two speakers and a view which I share, is that price on carbon, internalizing externalities, is, as I would characterize what they said, is necessary but not sufficient. So that there are many good reasons why we need it, and why if we don't have that, it's going to be very hard to be successful in many ways, but also in developing the kind of innovation and adoption of technologies. So it's necessary, but it's by itself, it doesn't solve all the problems. There are a number of other things that we have to address. And I would like to expand that in 2 ways. One is to ignoring the prices of carbon, just looking at the prices we've already got, and to say that the particular design of regulation and the need for better and smarter pricing is already there in front of us in a big way that is not appreciated often by people who are not following these issues. The first one, smarter pricing challenges, is to give you a sense of the scale and the range that we're talking about. Average energy prices in the electricity sector I'm talking about now, $50 a megawatt hour is a good round number. We have these canonical bid caps in these different markets of that are 20 times or more larger than that, so the maximum prices that you could charge. The average value of lost load is estimated by the Midwest is $3,500. In Texas, they're talking about it being over $9,000, and obviously in Australia, they think it's over $12,000 a megawatt hour. And if you look into the planning standards that are adopted in determining capacity requirements in order to meet reliability standards, the implicit value of lost load that you back out of those standards is in the order of several $100,000 per megawatt hour. So we have a huge range in the numbers here, which is indicative of a problem that basically we don't know what we're doing. And I can expand on why that's important and why it's an important problem. And maybe, if Paul, if you want to stop now, and then I can come back and finish up on this story before we get into the questions.
So, yeah, thank you all. I'm going to do a quick introduction for Bart Gordon, who is a committee member. He's going to introduce Representative Joe Barton. Just a quick thing. So Bart Gordon represented Tennessee for 26 years in the U.S. House of Representatives. During that part of that time, he was chairman of the House Science and Technology Committee, which authored the landmark Bipartisan America Competes Act, which in no small part came from a recommendation from another National Academy of Sciences study. Among many things it did, it created the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, which is housed in the Department of Energy, the sponsor of this study. And so I believe Bart will join us in just a moment and introduce Representative Joe Barton.
Pardon the